KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. In this hour, leaders of the United Kingdom and the European Union need to shore up support for Ukraine as White House relations with Kyiv falter. And BP said it was moving beyond petroleum, but now it's rolling back its investments in renewable energy. Plus, singer Allo Black's new album has a message for the world.
Rugged individualism does not sustain community. We need to really look toward people at our left and our right, people in front of us, behind us, as our support network.
It's Sunday, March 2nd. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer is hosting an emergency summit in London today. Invited leaders from the European Union, as well as Canada and Ukraine, will discuss the next step in ending the war in Ukraine. Allies were rattled by last week's White House meeting with President Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that ended in shouting and no resolution. In the U.S., House Speaker Mike Johnson says a solution must be found.
We have to bring about an end to this war in Ukraine. Putin is the aggressor. It is an unjust war. We have been crystal clear about that. But now is the time to bring it to an end.
Johnson was interviewed on CNN. Federal employees are again weighing how to respond to an email from Elon Musk asking them to detail what they accomplished during the past week. As NPR's Bobby Allen reports, it's part of Musk's White House initiative to root out government inefficiencies.
Federal employees have begun receiving an email with the subject line, "What did you do last week, part two?" The message, like one sent a week ago, instructs government employees to offer 5 bullet points highlighting their work. President Trump is supporting Musk's push to try to remove low-performing or what they deem unnecessary federal employees. Trump and Musk have also claimed, without evidence, that some federal workers receiving paychecks are dead or non-existent. Critics of Musk's strong-arm tactics say it's a mostly performative gesture to put civil servants on notice that their jobs are now vulnerable. Meanwhile, leadership at agencies have provided mixed guidance on whether workers should reply or not to the emails. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
A federal judge in Washington has ruled that President Trump acted unlawfully when he fired Hampton Dellinger as head of the Office of Special Counsel. That office enforces ethics laws, the employment rights of military veterans, and protects whistleblowers. Judge Amy Berman Jackson held the special counsel can only be removed for cause, such as neglect of duty or malfeasance of office. She ruled Dellinger must remain in the job. 3 years after resigning in disgrace, former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has announced he's running for mayor of New York City. Bruce Kienweiser reports.
With wide name recognition in New York and backed by deep-pocketed supporters, Cuomo becomes the frontrunner in a race that includes the incumbent, Mayor Eric Adams. Cuomo grabbed national attention during the early days of the COVID pandemic, seeming to strike all the right notes during daily press briefings. But within months, his political career crashed and burned amid multiple sexual harassment allegations. In the run-up to the June primary, New York City is beset by sky-high housing prices and crime concerns. Cuomo will face a stiff challenge from a class of political newcomers, as well as from the current mayor, who is mired in his own political scandals. For NPR News, I'm Bruce Kienweiser in New York.
This is NPR News in Washington. A U.S. aircraft carrier arrived in South Korea today. The South Korean Navy says the USS Carl Vinson is there to demonstrate the military alliance between the U.S. and South Korea in the face of threats from North Korea. It was accompanied by a guided missile cruiser and a guided missile destroyer. This comes days after North Korea test-fired strategic cruise missiles to show its military readiness. A Texas-based company has successfully landed a robotic probe on the surface of the moon, the first private company to do so without it crashing or falling over. As NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports, more landings could be coming soon.
The small probe was built by Firefly Aerospace. Early Sunday morning, it left its orbit around the moon and began its descent to the lunar surface. After a nail-biting few minutes, Mission Control confirmed touchdown.
IMU reports lunar gravity, and it is stable.
Y'all suck the landing. We're on the moon.
The landing makes the company the second commercial venture to land on the moon, and more private probes are on their way. In just a few days, the firm Intuitive Machines is set to make a landing attempt near the South Pole, and in May, a Japanese company will also try to get its probe to the surface of the moon. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
Hollywood honors its own tonight at the 97th Academy Awards. It takes place in Los Angeles, where parts were devastated by wildfires this year. The producers say the show will raise money for relief efforts. The hit film Wicked is nominated for 10 Academy Awards. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. President Donald Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky have had a difficult relationship dating back to Trump's first term. That long-standing friction erupted into an on-camera shouting match at the White House on Friday. And this very public dispute could have an impact on what comes next in the Russia-Ukraine war. For a look ahead, we're joined now by NPR's Greg Myrie, who has reported extensively on that war. Good morning, Greg.
Hi, Aisha.
So by now, most people have probably seen this Trump-Zelensky feud in the Oval Office. What does this mean for the U.S.-Ukraine alliance? Can it be fixed?
Well, I think we will see efforts to try and repair it. We don't know for sure what will play out. But what we can say is this outburst didn't come out of nowhere. There has been this tension dating back years, and we really saw it building in recent weeks. Trump threatened to withhold aid to Ukraine in a phone call with Zelensky back in 2019. That led to Trump's first impeachment. Trump openly questioned the value of aid to Ukraine during his presidential campaign. He recently called Zelensky a dictator and blamed Ukraine for starting the war. So Friday's meeting was supposed to smooth over these tensions, but it made things worse, much worse. Now, one important point, as the heat of that moment passes, it is likely Trump and Zelensky will find that they still need some sort of working relationship.
It's understandable why Zelensky needs Trump. Ukraine needs more military help. Talk to me about why Trump needs Zelensky if the U.S. president just wants to end the war as soon as possible.
Well, because to end the Russia-Ukraine war, both of these countries will have to make compromises. If the U.S. turns its back and cuts off aid to Ukraine, then yes, Ukraine will be weaker on the battlefield. It will feel pressure to make compromises. But what about Russia, which is quite happily watching this U.S.-Ukraine feud and expects to gain from it? Russia's leader Vladimir Putin has been willing to pay a very high price in both the troops and equipment for limited gains in Ukraine. If Russia starts making additional gains and feel Ukraine is becoming weaker, then Putin is likely to want to continue the war, not negotiate a ceasefire while he's advancing. So this U.S.-Ukraine tension could have the effect of making it harder, not easier, to negotiate an end to the fighting.
Do you have a sense of what kind of deal Trump wants to achieve?
Trump is sending a clear signal. He wants a deal to end the war as soon as possible. His priority is to do this quickly. Now, Trump and his team have spoken publicly about concessions that Ukraine will need to make, saying Ukraine won't be joining NATO, Ukraine won't get back all its territory. All this before the negotiations have really begun. And Ukraine's big fear is that the negotiations will largely take place between the U.S. and Russia, and then Ukraine will be pressured to accept a bad deal. And this would be a real reversal from the Biden administration, which isolated Russia and said there would always be no negotiations, nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine. And just one additional note, Britain's Prime Minister Keir Starmer, who's hosting Zelensky and European leaders today, said Britain, France, and Ukraine were working on their own ceasefire plan.
How badly would Ukraine be hurt if the U.S. cuts off military and diplomatic support?
Well, the blow would be substantial. The U.S. has given more military aid to help Ukraine than any other country. And consider just one example. Ukraine relies heavily on U.S. air defenses against missiles and drones that Russia unleashes most every night. Ukraine shoots most of them down, but without a resupply from the U.S., Ukraine would be very, very vulnerable.
That's NPR's Greg Myrie. Greg, thanks so much.
Sure thing, Aisha.
One of the things we accidentally canceled very briefly was Ebola prevention. I think we all want Ebola prevention. So we restored the Ebola prevention immediately, and there was no interruption.
That's Elon Musk speaking Wednesday at President Trump's first cabinet meeting. It's a comment that caught the ear of Jeremy Kleindike, who led America's response to the Ebola outbreak in 2014 as director of USAID's Office of U.S. Foreign Disaster Assistance. Jeremy Kleindike joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So you called that claim from Musk bunk. How so?
Well, almost everything he said there is wrong, apart from the fact that they had canceled the team. So there had been a team of about 60 people at USAID that worked on outbreak response. About 10 of them were focused specifically on Ebola specialization. That team of 60 people is now down to six. The team of 10 that worked on Ebola is now down to one remaining person. Also, while he was saying that, the State Department was drawing up preparations to cancel most of the programs that had been funded to respond to the current Ebola outbreak in Uganda. So at least four of the five awards that USAID had made to support that response effort were canceled by Friday of last week.
Well, there were 11 Ebola cases in the U.S. in 2014. Seven of those were people medically evacuated from abroad. Four were domestic laboratory confirmed cases. Give us an idea of how big the effort to keep Ebola at bay was, and how much of that was shouldered by the U.S.
It was a huge effort, ultimately, because during the critical early phase of the outbreak, not enough was done, not by the U.S. And not by the World Health Organization in that period, or the countries involved, to keep it under control when the case numbers were small. And so it got out of hand, it reached urban areas, and it began spreading in urban capitals in West Africa and really just exploded. That then became a much, much larger problem, requiring the deployment of the U.S. military, requiring a large deployment of a disaster assistance response team. That's the team that I oversaw, a major CDC deployment. And that, you know, that ended up costing huge billions of dollars in U.S. funding. It also killed 11,000 people, infected 28,000 people in West Africa. There's a real cost when one of these things gets out of hand. And the risk when you do a sort of weak response, as the U.S. is doing right now, and really barely a response, is you risk that kind of explosion again.
Well, talk to me, because more than 50 people have died in the western part of the Democratic Republic of Congo of something that's not Ebola or Marburg, but is similarly hemorrhagic, meaning that it causes excessive sickness and blood loss and leads very quickly to death, often just 48 hours after onset. So what are you watching in this outbreak in the DRC?
Well, the key thing you want to understand with any new, what's called a novel outbreak, meaning something that's unfamiliar that you maybe haven't seen before, is how is it spreading? How is it being transmitted? Because if it's transmitting human to human, that's very, you know, that can be very difficult to stop. What seems to be the case now, per the latest from WHO just yesterday, is that they think this may have been an infected water source creating this outbreak. In that case, you purify the water source and things should stop. So let's cross our fingers and hope that that's confirmed and that that's manageable. But what it really underscores is all over the world at any given time, there are lots of mysterious outbreaks. And it's really important to have WHO and the CDC on top of those in terms of the surveillance, to have USAID outbreak teams ready to respond and support the country and humanitarian partners in responding.
Well, can you talk to, explain to me how USAID working in another country affects U.S.? Because some people listening, and the argument may be, well, we're spending all this money in the U.S., the U.S. doesn't have it, and we can't help these other countries. We need to focus on the U.S. So what do you say to that?
So diseases don't need passports in order to travel. That's the bottom line. One of the things we invested in hugely in 2014 was traveler screening to prevent cases from reaching the United States after a few cases did reach the United States. Well, traveler screening is one of the things that was just cut by Elon Musk and the State Department. There had been traveler screening happening in Uganda to prevent export of cases. That has now been stopped.
So the idea is that it could cross the borders and get here. And then, I mean, how exposed would the U.S. be if the U.S. faced a similar situation to what happened or to what you faced in 2014?
There is always a risk that travelers could come here, take the disease here, and then begin spreading it. Now, I think what we saw in 2014 was cases were detected fairly quickly, and we didn't see it didn't spark a significant second wave of an outbreak here in the United States. But of course, with COVID, that did happen. We have seen other cases. The global HIV epidemic right now is really at risk of getting out of control because of these the foreign aid cuts by the Trump administration. That certainly would affect the United States. So there are all kinds of disease risks that can reach the United States and spread here and cause a lot of harm here if we don't control them overseas.
Can other groups step up and take the place of U.S. government funding?
There's really no donor that operates at the scale of the United States. Maybe Europe collectively does, but that's already in the system, and many European countries are cutting as well. So there really is nothing to fill this gap.
That's Jeremy Kneindike, who worked at USAID during the Obama and Biden administrations and is now president of Refugees International. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Israel says it's stopping all goods and supplies from entering the Gaza Strip, citing the refusal of Hamas to extend the first phase of the six-week-old ceasefire. Hamas released a statement accusing Israel of trying to derail the framework of the ceasefire agreement. Pope Francis issued a message from his hospital bed today, the third week he was unable to lead Sunday prayers. He thanked his doctors for his care and well-wishers for their prayers. And a private lunar lander touched down on the moon today. Firefly Aerospace became the first private company to put a spacecraft on the moon without it crashing or falling over. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. And from ECMC Foundation, at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was warmly greeted by UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer in London. It's in contrast to the heated meeting Friday with President Donald Trump that left relations with the U.S. in question. Starmer is hosting a group of European leaders to discuss how to provide more support for the country now 3 years since it was invaded by Russia. And he now says Britain, France, and Ukraine have agreed to work on a ceasefire plan to present to the U.S. We're joined now by Terry Schultz, who's following developments from Brussels. Hi, Terry.
Good morning, Aisha.
These weren't exactly the circumstances under which the British Prime Minister expected to host his European counterparts, were they?
Not at all. Now, Prime Minister Keir Starmer called this meeting of about a dozen EU heads of state and government, of course, before the spat in the Oval Office. And they were intending to discuss things like you just mentioned, their collective plan to help achieve peace between Russia and Ukraine, how NATO's European countries, together with Turkey and Canada, can do that, what they can offer, possibly even boots on the ground to monitor an eventual ceasefire. That's all been under discussion. So heading into this meeting, Starmer is sounding optimistic, as you say, that they'll come out of it with an agreement among countries there in London, which would then be presented to President Trump. But there are lots of questions, Aisha. Even the UK and France, which are the lead countries on this plan, have said that they would require this all-important American component of potential air power on standby in case their troops, who would be there in Ukraine, are attacked. And securing that crucial element becomes all the more difficult now that it's potentially an entire cutoff of American support for Ukraine.
Going beyond this UK-hosted meeting, I understand there's also a full European Union summit coming up in a few days focused on the same issues. Does this indicate how concerned Europeans are about how things are going with Ukraine? What can we expect from that?
Yeah, that's right. On Thursday, the 27 EU leaders will come to Brussels for a meeting focused entirely on defense. And again, this was scheduled before things went so awry in the Oval Office. And it was already unusual to hold such a high-level meeting on one subject only, defense and security. But that's how worried people already were, even before this last deterioration. Finnish President Alexander Stubb spoke yesterday on the Finnish national broadcaster YLE about how important this moment is for Europe. He started by saying what happened in Washington was astonishing and sad. But then Stubb looked for the silver lining.
Nyt on monella tapaa Euroopan hetki. Euroopan hetki toimia.
In many ways, he said, it's Europe's moment, Europe's moment to act. It's in our interest to support Ukraine, and it's in our interest that the alliance relationship with the United States within NATO continues to work. So again, like with the meeting in London, I expect the leaders are going to have to spend some time focused on how they can perhaps help repair relations between Washington and Kyiv, something they didn't exactly anticipate, as well as working on a new aid package they're planning for Ukraine, and they very much hope to approve it at this meeting. And that will include ammunition, missiles, and billions of euros in financial assistance.
There's also the NATO situation to consider with these new tensions with the U.S. NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte spoke out yesterday saying it's Zelensky's responsibility to fix the relationship. Is that just because the U.S. is a member of the alliance and Ukraine isn't? And will that have other implications for NATO?
Yeah, Ayesha, it's going to be awkward. And, you know, I think Mark Rutte, in an interview with the BBC, saying that it's up to the Ukrainian president alone to make up with Trump, was really speaking for himself and not the other 31 NATO allies, because after what happened in Washington, they came out immediately and really strongly telling Zelensky to be brave and be fearless and that they would stand behind him. So I don't think that there's going to be any impact on the assistance that these countries give, because it doesn't go through NATO. It's really bilateral aid. In fact, we may even see an increase as they feel the situation becoming ever more dire.
That's reporter Terry Schultz in Brussels. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be here.
Beyond darkness, there is light. Beyond a thorn, there is a rose.
Ever hear this ad?
Beyond petroleum, BP.
This BP, or British Petroleum, ad aired in 2005. That was when oil companies were coming under attack for everything from oil spills to global warming. They began to invest in alternative energy, in other words, beyond petroleum. Shell and Chevron invested in wind and solar. ExxonMobil put money into algae. Fast forward to today, they have all since doubled down on oil and gas. And BP's CEO just last week called it a reset. Nick Kuznets covers fossil fuels and energy for Inside Climate News. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. So after years of touting their shift to green energy and being friends of the planet, why are oil companies now doubling down on fossil fuels?
Well, I think a big reason, certainly for BP, is money, really, and investors. BP, in particular, has been coming under a lot of pressure from investors because it's been underperforming. And American companies have really outperformed their European rivals, particularly Shell and BP. And one of the biggest differences between the companies has been that the European companies have previously pledged to spend a lot of money on renewable energy. And the American oil companies really have maintained that they were going to be oil and gas companies.
At this point, this is about money, but wouldn't the time to invest in alternative energy be when companies do have cash? Because presumably with climate change, there will be, you know, issues with putting all this carbon in the atmosphere.
For sure. And there are definitely segments of the financial community that have been making exactly that case to them, that they need to prepare themselves for a future where oil and gas demand is falling, and they need to start diversifying and investing in other forms of energy. But I think the problem has been that transition isn't happening as fast as some people have hoped when oil demand is continuing to climb.
You know, there was always a question of how committed these oil and gas companies were to shifting energy production. And so I guess, like, what does it mean that BP is doing this reset? Were they putting a lot of money, really putting a lot of money into clean energy?
If you go back to 2020, soon after the Paris Agreement was signed, and there looked like there was some real momentum behind taking action on climate change. And that's when a lot of the oil companies began to say a lot more about climate. And the European companies took on net zero pledges. But as you said, I mean, a lot of people looked at these pledges really skeptically. They were long-term pledges, and they were just that. They were pledges. And this was one thing where BP, at least, stood out from the other major oil companies, and it said it was actually going to reduce how much it spent on oil and gas exploration and production, and it was going to reduce its oil output within this decade. And so it really stood out from that, and it said it was going to spend that money on renewables instead. And it started to do that. It was just the beginning of it. And BP now is basically saying that they're going to join with the American counterparts. They're going to increase their oil and gas spending once again, and scale back how much they spend on renewables.
that's ultimately the question with companies doubling down on oil and gas. Unless investors or governments push back or try to force changes, is it possible to meet climate goals, or is that not possible under these current conditions?
So one thing that the oil companies have said is that they essentially are responding to consumers, that they're not going to lead the world off of oil and gas. They can only move as fast as consumers are moving. And I mean, there's some truth to that. They're businesses, right? But I think what complicates a bit is when the companies are lobbying against policies that would actually speed that transition, you know, lobbying against policies that would quicken a move to electric vehicles, for example.
That's Nick Kuznets. He is a reporter for Inside Climate News. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Later today on All Things Considered with Scott Detrow. Mexico sent 29 members of drug cartels to the U.S. last week for prosecution on charges ranging from drug trafficking to homicide.
These are major players, right from the former heads of the CETAs. These were people who were accused of being involved in crimes like the mass disappearance of more than 400 people in one town, whose bodies were dissolved in metal barrels.
Who are they and why now? This afternoon, tune in on your phone, your smart speaker, or your radio. Modern Brazil is what it is today. The foods, the religious traditions, and of course the music, in large part because of its African roots. That's the message one of Rio de Janeiro's famous samba schools is delivering at this weekend's official carnival parade, as NPR's Carrie Khan reports.
The Mangueira Samba School's carnival song this year gets right to the point. The lyrics sing of the proud history of Rio's iconic hillside favelas or shanty towns, filled with homes built by Bantus, the Africans Brazilians refer to who were forcibly brought here during the slave trade from modern-day Angola and Congo, says one of Mangueira's researchers, Stephanie Paz.
A gente conhece as populações que formaram o Rio de Janeiro.
This population was one of the largest in Rio, says Paz, who I caught up with in a downtown warehouse as Mangueira workers put the finishing touches on their enormous floats. The Bantu's contributions to Brazil are huge, like in our gastronomy, she says, highlighting angu, a cornmeal-based polenta-like food still widely consumed here, and in language, she adds, words like samba, the famous musical genre, or moleque, which means a little kid. 28-year-old Valdemar Vargas is rooting for Mangueira this year.
I'm Mangueira, school of samba.
He's not only a big fan, but also works at the Pretos Novos Institute in the Rio neighborhood known as Little Africa. He gives tours of the site where the bones of tens of thousands of slaves were discovered. He takes us a few blocks away to a nearby plaza to see the remnants of the Valongo Wharf, where slaves disembarked.
It's a port to disembark 1 million people in Rio, the Africans.
A million African slaves came through Rio.
Come to Rio, yeah.
Through this port right here.
This port.
1 million of the nearly 5 million slaves brought to Brazil came through Rio. And the Institute says at least 60% of those slaves were Bantu. Our history is not very well known, he says. The city was built right on top to hide it, he says. The site was only recently discovered in 2011, as Rio was renovating before hosting the World Cup and the Olympics.
Erase memory of the black people.
They just constructed all over it.
In fact, many residents, I asked, didn't know what the uncovered stones of the once infamous Valongo Wharf were.
Fui pra lá. Tem porto hoje, porque o mar vinha até aqui.
Tá na televisão.
At the nearby bus stop, 64-year-old Jaira Moreira chimed in to explain to fellow riders.
O que é uma vergonha, porque meu filho nasceu no hospital de servidores.
Jacqueline Cruz says she had no idea. Her youngest son was even born in the hospital right next door. But Xinxia Lejo, a 43-year-old psychologist, is making sure her 13-year-old daughter knows Rio's history. The two are up in the city's northern zone at an evening practice session for Mangueira's carnival parade. Thousands are decked out in the school's bright pink and green colors. She says black people in Rio, and especially those from the poorer favelas, still suffer much prejudice. But carnival is ours, she says. Time to shine and show our pride.
Com a nossa realidade. Mangueira campeã. Mangueira campeã. Não tem jeito.
Because we know our reality, and Mangueira is the champion, she laughs. Carrie Khan, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. The instinct to help a fellow creature runs deep. We see the behavior in humans, elephants, and now mice. A new study published in the journal Science outlines what it calls prosocial behavior in mice who seem to be performing CPR on incapacitated mice. Li Zong is a professor of physiology and neuroscience at USC's Keck School of Medicine and is one of the co-authors of that study, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you for having me here.
So let's talk about the study. You and your colleagues temporarily knocked out mice with some medication or blocked their airways with a non-toxic ball. You noticed that the mice that were awake would try to help the unconscious mice?
Yeah, at the beginning, it's really a surprise for us. I mean, because nobody reported this kind of behavior in laboratory animals. In the literature, it seems that it's not reported before or it's not studied before how animal interact with an unconscious partner.
You say performing CPR, were they like pushing on them with their little paws, or how was it going?
The behaviors include several things, like starting from sleeping and then grooming and then more intensive interactions, like biting the mouse, biting the tongue, and a strong licking of the eye, and eventually pulling the tongue out of the mouth of this unconscious one.
They would pull the tongue out to clear their airway for the unconscious animal?
Yes, so that's our guess.
Wow, I mean, that seems really advanced for mice to know how to do that. And the helper mice who were doing this, they were very young, like 2 to 3 months old. So is it just instinct, or is this learned behavior?
Generally, like 2-3 months for mice is considered as young adults. Mm-hmm. And even at least for age up to like 6 months or so, they also show this kind of behavior. But those animals, they don't have this kind of prior experience with the unconscious one before. Mm-hmm. So that's why we think, okay, this is more likely innate.
It's not them learning it from the older mice. This is something innate.
Right.
Did these mice have to like know each other, like have dealings with the incapacitated mouse before, or did they help even strangers?
So turns out, okay, the behavior, the responses to cage mates for a long time, they show very strong responses. But if it's for a stranger, they've never been together before, then it's much less.
So how can understanding the interior life of mice and animals help with broader medicine?
Animal study, I mean, the purpose is more to understand a human being. This kind of behavior, also the study of its neural mechanisms, right, may also generate some insights to understand, okay, some neurological disorders, autistic patients or Alzheimer's disease patients. So if we understand the neural mechanisms from animal model, maybe that's also help us, okay, to understand what's going on, to generate some therapeutic strategies, right?
That's Li Zong, professor of physiology and neuroscience at USC's Keck School of Medicine. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
This is NPR News.
One of the top foreign policy challenges President Trump must confront during the second term is a country analysts believe is close to developing a nuclear weapon, Iran.
There's two ways of stopping them, with bombs or with a written piece of paper.
That story on the next morning edition from NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. European leaders are meeting in London today to discuss the war in Ukraine. The British Prime Minister says they agree that Europe must unite to secure the best outcome, which will be vital for Europe's security. President Trump has signed an executive order directing government agencies to find a way to increase lumber production in the U.S. A second orders the Commerce Secretary to look into the effect of lumber imports on national security as Trump considers imposing tariffs. And an international non-governmental organization placed a full-page ad in the New York Times today asking Americans to give money to make up for deep cuts in U.S. foreign aid. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. It's 1880s London, and in the city's grimy and dangerous East End, bare-knuckle boxers scrap it out in front of boisterous crowds. The toughest and most brutal of the bunch is Sugar Goodson. But he fears his crown is about to slip with the arrival of Hezekiah Mosco, who's just come from Jamaica.
Your brother just offered me £5 to take a fall in the third round.
I asked my brother to make arrangements because my heart cannot be trusted. And there are devils that pull the carriage I ride.
This Sugar is quite the character.
Oh, thank you.
He's a bad man.
He's complicated.
That's Stephen Graham. He's one of the executive producers, along with his wife, Hannah Walters, of the new TV show, A Thousand Blows. It's now streaming on Hulu. Graham also plays Sugar Goodson. To create such a complicated character, he built him from the ground up, starting with how Sugar walks, shoulders back, rolling from side to side with each solid step.
Different types of shoes and different shoes make you walk differently. You know, it can be like a heavy pair of boots or a light pair of training shoes, or you call them sneakers. So it's kind of finding the shoes that fit the character. And then once I'm in that man's shoes, I feel like I can embody him and walk his life. Do you know what I mean? Does that sound strange?
No, that doesn't sound strange at all. I mean, they say you got to walk in somebody's shoes, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm a great observer, like if I'm at a train station or an airport or anything like that, and I watch people's walks and I steal them and lock them away. I mean, it's a great little exercise. Try it when you're next in a big space, do you know what I mean? And just watch how different people walk completely differently. And you can watch someone's walk and then develop and build a character on them and create a whole world and a whole life about that particular person.
You play a bare-knuckle boxer in the series, Sugar Goodson. I mean, he's in great shape, so you were in great shape. Bare-knuckle boxing, like, that is kind of crazy. How did you train for this role?
It took me, look, because we executive produced the show, me and my wife, Hannah, we got the green light and we knew we had 6 months until we started shooting. So that gave me 6 months to get myself a trainer. And I also got myself a boxing trainer. And I put as much size on as I could. I'm only little, I'm only short. So I wanted to be like a little bulldog. And I looked at influencers and fighters of similar stature for me. So I based him on Mike Tyson. And so the hooks and the prowess of Mike Tyson in the ring, that explosive. So I really went for it and tried to get myself in the best physical shape and condition that I could so I could... you want to look like you know what you're doing, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I've learned from last time.
Brother, I watched you.
Watch me? What does that mean? Hey, what did you see?
I saw that you've slowed down. And that you came up against someone young and useful and... Well, you weren't fast enough.
And Sugar Goodson, he's a man who's kind of dominated this world in London's underbelly. He's starting to feel his control slipping away.
Yeah.
And it begins with this near loss in the ring to newcomer Hezekiah Masto. How did almost losing that fight affect Sugar Goodson?
I think for Sugar, in that first fight, for Sugar, it's kind of, look, he's the king of his castle. In that small part of London, he is the king. He's, him and his brother have built this from nothing there. Don't forget, they're two men who were in the poor school. So their parents passed away when they were young. And if Sugar has raised Treacle, he's had to fight for everything to get to where he is today. Do you know what I mean? Because back then, you know, a lot of children died young. And also at that time, the change from bare knuckle fighting to boxing as we know it today. So it was being gentrified. So it was the gentrification of boxing, which it was then for the upper classes to sit round and watch and be entertained. Whereas Sugar wants to hold on to the fact that it's from the streets and it belongs to the people and, you know, it's to keep the people entertained.
Have you dealt with people like that in your life, your career, who can't handle change too well? A lot of people can't handle change too well.
Yeah, I suppose that kind of, you know, that sense of identity and not wanting change and that keeping things as they are, they feel downtrodden. And each and every one of our characters in this thing, they're all fighting for survival. If you look at it, you know, Hezekiah comes over, he has these dreams and aspirations to be a lion tamer. And this is based on truth. And then if you look at Mary Carr, who was the head of the 40 Elephants, they were the most notorious thieves and villains of that era in England, in London, and they were a band of women, and they even, you know, they robbed Harrods. So all of these great stories that Steve has created.
You're talking about Stephen Knight, the creator and executive producer of 1,000 Blows.
Yes, and I just think it's so colorful and you know, it's that whole world looks so gritty and so vibrant, but yet it's all about survival.
All right, ladies.
I think Mary, Mary's one of the best characters ever, I think, personally. The elephants, I think they're fantastic.
Business is good. We're doing well, but real money ain't found at the bottom of a man's pocket. In the coming weeks, I'm going to need you all to be on your toes. Plans are forming.
As you said, the inspiration for these characters are real people. And I understand that there was a single photograph that really inspired the series, right?
Yeah, you're completely right. Me and my wife, Hannah, were sent a photograph, and the photograph was of Hezekiah Masto with a little tiny paragraph about his life. And then there was also a paragraph about Sugar Goodson and Treacle Goodson, who were the two brothers. And this photograph of Hezekiah, you know, I'm of mixed race myself. My granddad was from Jamaica, but I have never seen a photograph of a black man looking so regal, so full of pride and dignity and grace and humility from that particular period. Whenever you see photographs in that period of black people, they're normally in places of servitude. You're never told these stories. So instantly, Hannah, when she saw the photo, she was like, wow. What a beautiful image. I wonder how this man's got here. And instantly it makes your mind race and you come up with all kind of like possibilities of what has happened for this photograph to be taken at this particular point in time. And it was Hannah. Hannah just said, I know who's going to write this. And I was like, who, love? And she went, Steve Knight will write this. And I was like, what, you're crazy? How are we going to get Steve Knight to write it? And she went, trust me, Steve Knight's going to write it. And it all stemmed, like you said, it stemmed from that photograph, which just blew my mind, really. Do you know what I mean?
Just for fun, before we wrap up, you are British and you're in extra good shape thanks to this role.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's an opening for 007. Would you be interested in being the next James Bond?
If I can be completely honest, my answer to that is no.
Oh.
Not really. Not for me. But no. I don't, you know, I like James Bond. I love James Bond and all that, but not for me. You'd never get a working class James Bond. You know what I mean? What I would love to do is I would love to be a baddie. I'd love to be a villain in a James Bond film. Mm. That would suit me a bit more, I think.
I could see that. I could definitely see that.
You have more fun being the villains anyway in James Bond films, I think.
I agree. That's actor and producer Stephen Graham, whose new show, 1,000 Blows, is streaming now on Hulu. Thank you so much for talking with us about it.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. I'm really glad to be on your show. Thank you.
Here's where Allo Black finds inspiration and grace.
The African proverb that says, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together.
I'm no sinner, but I've sinned.
The musical artist has just released a new album, his 6th. It's called Stand Together, and it meditates on the need for compassion and community in the United States and beyond.
Rugged individualism is a concept that does not foster, support, or sustain community. We need to really look toward the people at our left and our right, the people in front of us, behind us, as our support network.
Don't go alone. Don't go alone. Don't go alone. If you go by yourself, you can go much faster. But if you wait for me, we can go much farther. Don't go alone.
Allo Black's message was shaped by personal experiences and observations.
Since high school, I've had a number of friends deeply affected by substance abuse, and in some cases culminated in self-harm. And so, to the extent that I can be helpful, I want to offer my words that my friends or that others that I don't know who are struggling can have to overcome their situation.
Were there things happening in your life while you were making this album that made you want to put out these sorts of messages?
Yeah, absolutely. There's always something. You know, I'm a global citizen and I recognize challenges across the world. And I also recognized community heroes standing up and holding a community on their shoulders.
Not on my watch. Oh, not on my watch. Not while I'm around with all the love that I've got. Not on
you have a song, Not On My Watch. That one has more of an acoustic, almost country sound. What's this song about?
You know, Not On My Watch was inspired by a documentary film called Following Harry. It's about the last decade or so of Harry Belafonte's life and how he was passing the torch of activism and artistry to the next generations of artists. But the reason why this song is with sort of an acoustic feel is because of this legacy of movement music, the Pete Seegers and the Woody Guthries, who used their voices to speak truth to power, just their voice and a guitar.
The greed of businessmen at work, the selfish need to be ranked first, pollutes our air, poisons earth. And leaves our sacred waters cursed. But God made everybody equal. So fight for power to the people. And make a vow you won't allow another mother's tear to drop. Not on my watch. Oh, not on my watch.
Well, can I talk to you about how your love for music began? I understand you began playing the trumpet in elementary school.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to be at a school that still had a music program and became a fan of jazz music, you know, Dizzy Gillespie, and he had a song called Eminon, which is no name backwards. So I named my first hip hop group Eminon. Hip hop was my very first love. Got deeply involved in writing lyrics, started recording. In hip hop, we sample from so many different genres. So I was sampling from classic rock, classic jazz, soul music. And it was the singer-songwriters within these genres that inspired me to start writing in a different way and starting to use melody in a different way.
You said you are a global citizen, and you can kind of, I felt like I kind of heard some of that on this album. There were some Caribbean vibes. I said to the mother, mother, mother. See, that's Marvin Gaye's What's Going On. This is your interpretation of it. What made you go in that direction?
Yes. Well, Marvin Gaye, one of his contemporaries is Bob Marley. And I wanted to do this sort of musical dialogue between Marvin Gaye and Bob Marley. So roots reggae and classic soul, because of the way that these two individuals, these two artists showed up with message music, which I think is one of the things that I'm trying to impress upon my peers, is that as much fun as you want to have as an artist, have your fun, but also give us some substance, because there's an opportunity for that fun to translate in joy and action. And that's what I got from Buffalo Soldier as much as I got from What's Going On. What's going on?
There is so much division and anger in this country right now. What do you want your music to give to people, especially at this moment? And what do you say to those people who may say, well, I don't want to come together with everybody right now. I don't know that we need to be standing together.
Well, I look at my heroes, Nelson Mandela, Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., and I think about what they would say. All of my heroes had to contend with their so-called enemies. They had to speak to them. They had to be in rooms with them and negotiate. And at the end of the day, we have to be able to listen to our better angels.
Now it's obvious we don't see the world the same. You've got your point of view on what you feel is true. No, we don't have to play that silly game of who's more right than who. But even if you do, I'm gonna try to listen to you. Give you
That's musician Allo Black talking about his new album, Stand Together. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, I appreciate you.
But maybe we can agree on one thing. We can change this world forever if we all just stand together, put our differences aside.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Never, don't we all deserve much better? Won't take long to realize that we're all the same inside. If we stand together. If we stand together.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands, with therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. From Yarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.